Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hi, welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, I am thrilled to virtually sit down with writer, feminist, and freelance journalist, Millie Hill. Millie is the author of best-selling books, Positive Birth Book, Give Birth Like a Feminist, and a book for preteen girls titled My Period. From 2012 to 2021, she founded and ran the Positive Birth Movement, a global network of antenatal discussion groups aimed at improving birth and giving women better access to support and information. As a journalist since 2013, Millie has written for many publications, including Telegraph, Guardian, Independent, Mother and Baby, just to name a few. And she's appeared on BBC Radio, Talk Radio, LBC, and many other leading podcasts. In recent times, Millie has become interested in cancel culture and has had her own experiences of this phenomenon. Currently, she is in the early stages of a fourth nonfiction book and lives in Somerset with her partner and three children. As you'll hear on today's show, Millie has a passion for reframing the narrative around women's bodies. And as a writer about female biology, she is curious about the current misinformation about sex and gender and the implications of shifts in word definitions for women's rights. Millie, thank you so much for joining us today on Venus Rising.
Thank you for inviting me, Callie. It's lovely to be here.
So I have so much I want to talk with you about today. I hope we can squeeze most of it in. But
okay. I'll try and talk fast.
It's okay. So first off, let's talk about your writings. You have three books. The most recent, My Period, that's for girls aged 9 to 13 and is filled with information and positivity, something we need, about periods and puberty, and a book I'm definitely going to have my daughter read when she's able. It's such an important topic, and to have positivity about it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the sort of teaching around periods is still so sort of stuck in the dark ages, so we really need that. That's why I wanted to write that book, to bring something fresh, because I think a lot of women our age are kind of like learning a lot more about their bodies suddenly, and it's really empowering for them. But like for me, I was like in my 30s before I started to find out a lot of these things about cycles and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, you know, I just thought, well, kids should know this, you know?
Yeah, we just don't do a very good job teaching young girls about their bodies and to be positive about it. It's very hush hush. And I honestly think maybe dads should even read this book, right? Like to give them a little glimpse and give a little positivity to it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, a lot of dads now are really good about these things, and it varies from family to family. But, you know, sometimes I think we just pass these taboos and these kind of stigmas on without necessarily even realizing it. Like one really interesting question I ask people is, where do you keep your period products? And some people keep them hidden away, and they always make sure, you know, they wait around in the bathroom to do a double flush if they've got their period, so nobody sees any blood in the toilet and everything. And you know, I can kind of understand that from one perspective, but from another point of view, if you've got little toddlers in the house and they come in and they see, it's like it's a good opportunity. They say, "Mommy, what? Mommy's bleeding." What, you know, you can talk to them. What? So that's mommy's period. It's nothing wrong with that, you know. And these, you know, we keep these things so hidden away that sometimes even just doing that is passing something on. You know, we might be doing it with good motivations, but we're kind of still passing on a kind of anxiety around it.
I like that. I like that. Your next book, which my personal favorite, Give Birth Like a Feminist, is for anyone interested in why birth is a feminist issue. You don't have to be pregnant to read this book, and you certainly don't have to be a woman either to read this book. And we'll talk more about that book in a little bit, but do you have anything you'd like to add right now?
Well, you know, I'm really proud of that book, actually. I think that was my my big labor of love. You know, I was really privileged to be able to write it. It was one of those books where, you know, when I went to my first meeting with the person who's now my agent, and she asked me what ideas I had for a second book, because my first book, The Positive Birth Book, was quite successful. She wanted to know what I wanted to write next. And I had this long list, and Give Birth Like a Feminist was at the bottom of the list. I was kind of a little bit shy to even say it because I thought she's going to think I'm a bit nuts, you know. So I kind of like wheeled out my other ideas, and I was like, well, there is this one other thing, you know, and she was like, oh, that's really interesting. So that for me, I thought that was a really interesting moment, not just for me personally, but in the kind of like whole conversation around women's bodies and birth, because, you know, suddenly I was talking to her, she had nothing to do with that particular world. You know, there are a lot of people within the world of, you know, birth and breastfeeding and everything who do talk about the links around feminism. But at that point, I felt like no one outside of that bubble was really talking about it. And then there I was, and then suddenly I was pushed into the offices of two big publishers in London to talk about why birth is a feminist issue to these people who, again, had no sort of like vested interest in that particular topic. And so, and then, you know, it got published. So I think, you know, for me, that was like, I just feel really proud of that book. And, you know, I kind of really want, I mean, every writer wants everyone to read their book, but I want everyone to read that book. But even, like you say, women who aren't pregnant or have never been pregnant or maybe never even want to be pregnant, because it's like, it's so important. So many women are going through this experience, the birth experience. And so many of those women are coming through it feeling that their bodies didn't work very well, that they failed, you know, that they didn't get the experience they wanted. Maybe they got their hopes up too high, and many of them are traumatized or just really shocked and sad. And you know, that is such a huge problem that we've got, you know, for women, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female or whether you never want to have children, you should still really care that so many women are having that trauma in their lives and carrying it, and they never forget it. That's the other important thing about birth, is that women never forget that day, however it plays out, for the whole of the rest of their lives. So it's kind of like, it has such a sort of juggernaut impact on every woman who does have a baby, that it's just something that everyone should care about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you haven't had a baby yourself or don't want to, chances are you probably have supported someone, a sister, another friend, through their experience. And so again, like you said, it can really open the eyes to anyone. And I honestly think too, that anyone in the profession of taking care of women in the birth space should read this book as well. I wish I could hand a copy to all my nurse friends, like, here, read this.
It's also kind of like a vector for, you know, other issues around women's bodies as well. I think, you know, the way that we think about women, and the way that we treat women and relate to them as people and to their sexed bodies and their birthing bodies and their physical bodies, it kind of like all links together with other areas that, you know, like, for example, abortion or, you know, autonomy in healthcare generally. You know, there's loads of other areas, or even just like sexuality, you know, relationships with men, all of these sort of things around consent and who, you know, whose body is it? You know, I know you had her on your, I listened to your podcast with Isabel, isn't it? The other day.
Yes.
It's a good, I was thinking about the title of that podcast, thinking, whose body is it? That's just such a good question.
That's the kind of question
we're talking about, isn't it? You know, that is, even if it's to do with childbirth itself, but it's also to do with women's autonomy, women's, you know, body boundaries, so much. So it's not just about birth.
Agree. And then your last book, like you said, which was a huge success, The Positive Birth Book, A Comprehensive Guide to Getting Ready for Birth, with some humor and some feminism thrown in there too. I didn't read this book. I wish I would have read it as well before I just gave birth to our daughter. I felt like I knew what I wanted. And I, being a labor and delivery nurse and someone who's pretty outspoken and knows what I want, I felt very secure going into that. But I think this book would have just added that much more to it. So I encourage those who are pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant, reading this book.
Yeah. We're going back in time, actually. You say my last book, but it's actually my first book.
So right. From, sorry. Like, yes.
Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. I mean, but yeah, it's, you know, looking back over those three books, I mean, they all have the same theme going through them in a way, which is that, you know, women's bodies are strong. Everything you've been taught to feel probably about your female body is wrong. or, you know, and you need to go down into maybe your lower levels of your consciousness a bit as well, you know, so you might think, oh yeah, I feel really fine about my female body actually. But, you know, there is stuff if you dig down. And, you know, when it comes to the big events like giving birth, that's when it kind of perhaps rears its head, you know, and comes to the surface. So yeah, that book is a bit like the period book, which is for 9-year-olds. It's the same formula. It's like a big reframe. It's saying, hang on a minute, everything you've been led to think here, let's just pick it apart. Let's take it to bits. Let's clean all the moving bits of it, put it back together and see what we have then, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's the whole point of it is to say to women, it doesn't matter how you choose to give birth, because that's another thing about the whole birth conversation is we get all this judginess around, you know, what type of birth you have, whether or not you choose to have pain relief, blah, blah, mm-hmm. Whether it's in hospital, whether it's at home, all of these things. And this is about positive birth. So positive birth is what does that mean to you? You take ownership of that. You decide what's positive for you. And then you get informed and you know, have a positive experience in which you feel, you know, you have your autonomy and you feel that, you know, your body, your female body gets the best chance to do what it should be able to do. So it's kind of this is a theme that runs through all the books, really.
So what made you so passionate for writing these books for women and girls?
Well, I don't know. That's a pretty good question. It's always hard to know, isn't it, where these things come from, and you just sort of follow the paths through life. But I guess what happened for me was before I was a mom and before I started having kids myself, I worked as a therapist. So I was really interested, I suppose, already in what's going on under the surface, you know, the psychology of things, how mind-body relationship and all that kind of stuff. And also I was and always have been a feminist. And so when I was first pregnant and had my first baby, I just became really fascinated by those two angles, I suppose, of pregnancy and birth, you know, the feminist angle and also the kind of like, how are we thinking about this and what's happening in our conscious and our unconscious and what are the messages and can it be reframed and all of those kind of psychological aspects. So I guess those two things came together for me. And I just thought, basically, as a feminist, I met women before I had kids. I never really spoke to anyone who'd had a baby. I never even held a baby. It was this world we live in now, isn't it? You know, I was in the world of work, nobody had kids. So the people who had kids were like all really old and boring and never went out. And so, you know, you have this sort of like divide, don't you, between.
Right.
And I didn't really have any connection to that world. But suddenly, having a baby threw me into these conversations and these friendships and relationships with women suddenly who had babies and given birth. I was like, the number of stories that I was hearing from women of how traumatic and appalling mm-hmm. and disgraceful their treatment was mm-hmm. during childbirth. And this is not like because I went looking for them. This is just randomly, you know, you're at the soft play or whatever. So, you know, that just put my feminist back up, I suppose, my own personal experiences and then hearing story after story from other women. I was like, surely we can do better than this. So I think it just lit a few fires for me and made me realize that there was a whole area of women's lives that was kind of being, you know, just pushed aside. I mean, we're going back sort of 10 or 15 years now, and I think things have changed. And I'm not saying I was the first woman to have these thoughts. You know, women have been having these conversations and trying to improve birth for decades.
Yeah.
But I was another one of those women that kind of had the light bulb put on for her and just thought, you know, something needs to change about this. And then at the same time, as the sort of side hobby to being in that very intense phase of parenting very small children, I'd started writing a blog. So then I discovered actually this is writing is what I should be doing. Great, isn't it? When you go through life, it's like, I think my mom probably told me when I was about 10, you should write. And then I was like, oh, I'm just going to ignore that. She's my mom. She doesn't know anything. And then
she's right all along.
Yeah. 20 years later, I was like, actually, maybe I am quite good at writing. So that's when I started writing. And then one thing led to another and that sort of snowballed for me and ended up doing journalism, and then the journalism turned into the first book. So,
wow,
it's kind of like lots of threads of the tapestry there, but that's how it all came together.
That's great. You hit on something there. You were talking about how you had all these stories before you even started writing the books. And that's something I really liked about Give Birth Like a Feminist. One, that you have so many wonderful quotes from people who have gone before you and have brought up these kind of issues. And then also that you bring in the stories from other women. Were there any stories that you heard that really just like shook you, or did you feel like, oh, like kind of like, oh, this is what I expected to hear?
Well, I think when you listen to traumatic stories a lot, it does have a toll on you, and it sort of works in two strange ways. One, it kind of like you become a bit desensitized, and you know, you find yourself like, oh yeah, here's another traumatic birth story, scroll through, yeah, epidural, yeah, I felt really sad, you know, and kind of like you lose your human connection to it. But at the same time, it's like the slow drip effect, and after a while you can start to feel quite burnt out. And I think that's definitely happened to me from, you know, I mean, when you're a therapist and you're listening to difficult stories all the time, you do a lot of work and you have a lot of supervision to kind of like unpack it and, you know, compartmentalize it and put it away and deal with how it's affecting you personally, blah, blah, blah. I don't think I've necessarily always had the time as a busy mom to do that self-care of processing, listening to other people's stories. So yeah, it does definitely have a toll on you. And I've heard so many. One that sometimes I keep coming back to, because I've written about it in a few different places as well, and it's so indicative of what can happen to women, is the one of, I didn't give birth like a feminist, of the woman who was having a home birth, and she was nearly about to give birth to a baby, and the midwife said to her, I want you to do a vaginal exam to see how dilated you are. And the woman was like, what, you know, I don't need this now, you know, I'm literally about to, you know, start pushing, kind of thing. And the midwife said to her male partner, I don't know if he was a husband or whatever, can get her, she needs to have this exam, get her to get out, tell her to get out of the pool. So he did, in the heat of the moment, as you can imagine, you know, we're in the intensest stages of labor here. And then the woman did the exam, and it was painful and uncomfortable and traumatic and awful. And then the woman got back into the pool and had the baby. And then they didn't talk about it. That. And then after the birth was over and, you know, the beginning and of the new baby and all of that, she kind of came back to it, and she was like, and her husband did as well. And they were both like, what the heck just happened there? You know, the guy was complicit in a violation of his woman's body. And do you see how much there is to unpick in just in that one? I just find that story so interesting, because there's so much in that one story that tells you almost everything you need to know about what's going wrong, you know, in all of the, it's a very reflective of so many other stories that I've heard, where a woman, and that one, it's interesting because the guy ended up complicit. And so then they, as a couple, had a lot to process in what he had done, and he had felt so bad about what he'd done. And, you know, it's really complex, but there's so many other stories as well where women find themselves going along with something because it's just what happens, you know, in inverted commas. And that's why, you know, a few years ago, when I give birth like a feminist, I write about the idea of Me Too in the birth room, because it's very similar to that thing that women kind of woke up about, not that we weren't aware of it already, but you know, that Me Too sort of light bulb going on, where you kind of went back to, say, 20 years ago in that office you used to work in, and you were like, oh, actually, that what happened then, that wasn't right, you know? And you just kind of like, it wasn't like you didn't know at the time it wasn't right, but you just kind of like didn't think about it, you didn't let yourself. And then Me Too suddenly turned something on for you, and you were like, and then you could see that happening in so many women, because that's why the whole thing snowballed on social media, because everybody just suddenly went, oh my God, that happened to me. That, oh, that happened to me. What, that was wrong? I suppose it was wrong. Now that you've said it's wrong, I can see it was wrong, you know? And yeah. In birth stories, there's so many of those moments as well, which they're not necessarily like a headline front page news, you know, this terrible thing happened to this woman. They're just tiny, but they're so violating, and they stick with women for the rest of their lives, and they niggle at women, you know, and they just don't feel right. But there isn't a way to talk about them so much, because when women try to tell those stories, they kind of get soothed and told, well, you know, the midwife probably was just really concerned, you know, she just really needed to know, you know, you can imagine the processing afterwards. And then sometimes, just like with Me Too, so much time goes by that it's kind of too late to make a complaint, you know, or, you know, it's just so similar. So I hope that, I rambled on to answer your question there, but you know, that's the sort of the effects the stories have, you're asking about, and that's kind of how it's come along with me.
You use the term in the book, obstetrical violence. And I appreciate, though, that you also bring up the fact that it's not personal. It's not like usually that the care provider is, you know, trying to be unempathetic or uncaring or blatantly go against a woman's consent, but that it's systemic. So would you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, I think it is really important to stress that, because when we have these conversations, it can be very hard for people who work within the maternity system to hear them and to really let, you know, be present for them, just in the same way as we have the kind of not all men that comes up straight away when we start talking about Me Too, or, you know, women's feeling uncomfortable about their safety, etc. So, yeah, obviously, you know, it is not a, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about a cultural problem. You know, there's a great essay about this called Fish Can't See Water. And it's, you know, pointing out that, you know, all of us, me, you, everybody, no one's like better than anyone on the, at this. We all swim around in our culture, and we, you know, we don't always notice practices that are wrong because they are just the way things are done. And I think that's what happens in maternity care too. And obviously, I mean, I don't know what the situation is like in the USA so much, but here in the UK, we have massive problems with funding and shortage of midwives. So that makes it really difficult as well. But, you know, sometimes we have to have these hard conversations, don't we? We have to have, that's why we need women's voices on this, just in the same way as we've had with Me Too. We need women to say, yeah, we know you didn't mean to do this. But when you, we need them to tell their stories and say, when you did this, it made me feel this, mm-hmm. because there isn't enough of that. There's too much kind of placatory talk of, oh, well, we just had to get the baby out, and you just, you know, look at the lovely little baby in your arms, right. and that sort of soothing, all that matters is a healthy baby stuff. But that we need to have these conversations, even if they're hard for care providers to hear, because, you know, women are not getting what they need at the moment in childbirth.
Right. It's not all about having a healthy baby at the end. We also need to have a woman who feels empowered. And what, and this should be the time that they feel most empowered and most in control and most cared for and promoted yeah. to, you know, their, I mean, they're about ready to yeah. be a mother, maybe for the first time, maybe for second or third time or more, but to go into motherhood with the idea that they had power over their experience.
Exactly. I mean, everybody being alive at the end of childbirth is a great goal, but it should be the baseline, right. not the pinnacle. right. And, you know, and healthy is an interesting word as well, because, you know, mums, you know, new mums, you know, who are traumatized or physically damaged from the experience as well, you know, will struggle or can struggle to, you know, it's difficult to talk about this because you don't want to say, oh, someone had a traumatic birth, can't bond as well. That isn't how it is. It's complicated. It's nuanced. But if you go into new motherhood feeling empowered and strong and like you've just done something great, you know, and you it's going to have a ripple effect on how you parent, on how you've whether or not you have you know, postnatal depression, how you relate to your partner and how that relationship plays out, your confidence levels, your physical, how you feel about your body, mm-hmm. your self-esteem, you know, and your, maybe even your future career, because you know your, how you strong you feel, powerful mm-hmm. you feel. So all of these things, you know, are important for women. The experience has a knock-on effect that can have small ripples out into every area of her life. And the women that, the really interesting women to talk to, well, all women who've had babies are interesting to talk to, but one group I find really interesting to talk to are the group who have had really blooming, amazing, empowering births. They are normally a very small niche group. So it's actually quite hard to get, you know, in spite of this sort of idea that there's this real agenda for natural birth, it's actually quite difficult to have a birth these days where, you know, and I'm talking about women who say maybe give birth where they still have a midwife or, you know, someone with them, but they give birth themselves. They, maybe they're in a pool, maybe they're in their bedroom or whatever on the floor, they give birth without anybody else touching them or telling them what to do.
Right.
Those women are really interesting to talk to because they will talk about how they felt like a lioness or, you know, a goddess or, you know, a mountain, you know, erupting and the world, whole world shifting. And they use all these huge metaphors for how kind of like seismic and powerful and incredible the experience was, you know. And you think, wow, that's really interesting because there's such a tiny group. But imagine if every woman who had a baby have that experience, because it kind of like, you know, my kids play a lot of computer games and we kind of go talk about the idea of it sort of taking you up a level, you know, that thing where you go, blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
you know, and you get the whole new, the whole new like outfit and little things start sparkling around you and you go boop, up a level into a completely different world, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of like what it should be like.
Yeah. I can't imagine a world. And it's interesting that, you know, and you talk about this a little bit in your book, but how, even though it is a small group of number and we want to hear those stories, how even sometimes we hush those women though, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to hear about your positive story because mine was so traumatic, or, you know, it's just interesting. And you brought it up earlier too, about this doesn't mean that it has to be an unmedicated natural birth. If that's not what you want, it's about what you want and going into it, knowing what your rights are and what you desire out of it. All births don't have to be natural. It's, you know.
Sure. But a lot of women, when they do actually learn about their options and their choices and their rights and their bodily autonomy and everything, do come around to thinking, well, actually, if I can, that's the kind of birth that I want to have.
Right.
Because nobody's going to say, I mean, I'd be unlikely to say, I'd really like to give birth with my feet in stirrups and like 10 people at the bottom of the bed.
Right, with steps, a light on.
You know? Like, who wants that?
Right.
You know, but if you do, fine. I'm not criticizing anyone for their choices. But, you know, I think a lot of women will say, you know, well, if I can, I would like to have a natural birth. And of course, now, you know, you can watch these videos on places like Instagram of those types of birth, and that it's becoming even more available than it was like when I started writing about births 15 years ago. You know, it was harder to see those sorts of births, but now women can actually see women having these experiences and celebrities doing it, and it's, you know, it does look appealing.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you can actually do it, you know, is a revelation sometimes, I think, because women are terrified of giving birth. And they think, well, I'm not going to be able to do that, you know, but then they can actually watch someone else do it. And that, yeah, helps. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to shift a little bit here. At our work at the Center for Bioethics and Culture, where I work, we take a critical look at what we call big fertility. So basically the profiting of women's wombs and eggs. And you talk a lot in your book, Give Birth Like a Feminist, about women being permission givers. And you actually state that women have the human right to be the key decision maker over what happens in their body and be listened to and be treated with respect. So I'm curious your thoughts, just want to pick your brain, on surrogate mothers and maybe the contracts that they might enter into that might dictate the terms of their pregnancy or even their birth experience. Some of them sign up saying, I will have a C-section on such and such date so the intended parents can be there. I will do. So do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's something that I'm kind of still learning about, really. It's a topic that hadn't really come up on my radar so much before I started to, you know, become involved in gender critical feminism and learn more about that. And then that obviously takes you into radical feminism. And then there's a lot of women in that field who are talking a lot about surrogacy, which was something which I had only, being in the UK, I had only ever come across surrogacy stories, like personally, like not talk about on the internet, but surrogacy stories personally of altruistic surrogacy. So, and that happens a fair bit. So, I mean, I know people who have had babies that way, who've had sisters or aunts or whatever, who have carried their baby for them and made it possible for them to have a baby where they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And so obviously that has its own issues, I realize, and I'm coming to realize. And in fact, I've spoken to one woman who did that, who regrets it. So I think that it's complicated. But then I also know someone who, should I say, benefited from it, became a mum through it, who it has been transformative for her and for her life. Sure. So it's there are different perspectives. And obviously commercial surrogacy just is a completely different area where I find it much easier to say, no, that's wrong. Yeah. But altruistic surrogacy is my only kind of like frame of reference, really. And I find that more complex, and I'm still trying to understand the issues around it, really. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. where I'm at.
Yeah. I just thought about it as I was reading a lot through that book of just permission givers and permission seekers. And then, the statistics we know about lower, again, this is commercial surrogacy, lower socioeconomic status, as women are already more likely to be less listened to and have poor outcomes. And yet those are the women that are often serving as commercial gestational surrogate mothers.
Yeah.
Birth room. And then your point in the book too about infant attachment, and that also plays a role in surrogacy as well, as the infant being swept off to the intended parent or parents.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It doesn't seem right, but I feel it's a minefield, and like I say, I feel unqualified to weigh in too heavily on it. But sure. I can see, like you say, that there is definitely, like I was saying at the beginning of our chat, about how my book is kind of like a vector of, you know, for other issues. I think obviously, yes,
sure.
the whole idea of what women's, whose body it is and what women's bodies are for is raised very much by the issues around surrogacy. And it is an area that I definitely need to read more about. Mm-hmm. But I just haven't at the moment been able to
you are
do that,
busy.
But I will.
Yes. No, you kind of hit on the next topic I'd like to talk about in the gender critical space. So we're just going to go there. As you are aware, we have had and will have more guests on the show that have been canceled for some of the work that they do, or for things that they have said on various social media platforms. And you have had this experience as well, and you articulate it quite well on your website as someone who advocates for women being silenced in their birth care. What was your experience like when people were trying to silence you? And do you mind sharing a little bit about that experience?
No, I don't mind sharing it about it at all, actually. In fact, I really like talking about it, because for a long time, I didn't talk about it at all. And it was one of the most horrible, toxic experiences that I've ever been through. And it did just sit quietly inside me for such a long time that now I'm like, yay, I can talk about it. And it feels such a release. But basically, it's kind of a long story, but the long and the short of it was, I'd been reading and learning a little bit more through the pandemic, through 2020, about gender critical feminism and gender identity ideology, and becoming more and more what people call peaked, just thinking, what the heck, this is a house of cards. None of this makes sense. And I'd part of what made me curious about it and pushed me into learning more about it was the attitudes that I was coming up against in the so-called birth world, especially in social media groups and things like that, where, people were insisting on, the use of the words, the term birthing people, mm-hmm. and assigned female at birth and those sorts of things. And I was asking questions about those and just saying, why do we have to say this? Who decided this? That kind of questions, what's it, where's it coming from? And, especially as I write, I was really interested in terminology change and word change. And it was like, you can't ask questions like that, very sort of, the response was a bit strange always, like a lot of people getting really angry and really sort of like shutting things down and admin, can someone step in here, please? Those sorts of discussions on Facebook groups that we're all kind of familiar with these days. And, that piqued my interest. I was thinking, why are we having to say women and birthing people all the time? And, I was kind of, that sent me down on a journey of like listening to a lot of podcasts and doing a lot of reading. So by November 2020, I was already kind of a year or so into that. And I started to just be a bit braver on social media. And somebody tagged me in this post on Instagram, which was a set of different tiles. And on one of the tiles, it was the International Day to End Violence Against Women, and it was a post for that. So that someone tagged me in it, because it was about obstetric violence. Mm. I'm trying to remember what it said. It said, birthing people, birthing people, not vessels, birthing people are seen as the weaker sex or something like that. And I was like, that's so silly because the fragile sex, that's what it said. Birthing people are seen as the fragile sex. And I thought, that's so funny that they put those two things together because you're talking about sex-based depression and talk about the fragile sex. You know, you're talking about, you know, quite a lot of, you know, feminist backstory to that phrase, the fragile sex. And then you're de-sexing it by saying birthing people. No, this doesn't make sense.
Right.
So I didn't expect anyone to even see the comment, but I wasn't rude. I just said, you know, it's not people who are seen as the fragile sex. It's women. You know, let's not forget who we're talking about here and why. Yeah. Obstetric violence happens to women because they're women.
Right.
And it was very, very, it was literally like that. And carried on doing the homeschooling or whatever I was doing. And all hell broke loose after that. That was what triggered this whole kind of massive social media pylon onto me. And there were all these, I was being tagged, my phone was going off constantly for about 48 hours over the, you know, and for a long time after that as well, but like ping, ping, ping for about 48 hours with people tagging me in posts, just saying that I was this white, privileged, transphobic, bigoted, right-wing, Nazi, TERF, throw my books in the bin. I was toxic. I was violent. I was dangerous. You know, all of these things, all because I just, all from that one.
Right, that one mention.
It was extraordinary. And then in the midst of it all at like 11 o'clock at night on the first evening, the day it happened, I got this email from the CEO of an organization that's based in the UK called Birthrights, who I'd worked. I wasn't ever employed by them, but I had worked as, you know, associated with mm-hmm. them for mm-hmm. a decade, supported them, donated to them, written about them in my books. They're in Give Birth Like a Feminist. And, you know, I'd spoken at their conferences and I got an email from their CEO saying that they wouldn't be able to work alongside me in any capacity in the future because that I didn't, you know, oh, was it there? Again, I can never remember. I try to put these things out of my head now because it's like a couple of years ago. So I try not to sort of walk around memorizing every single phrase, but, you know, I wasn't aligned with their values basically. Sure. And, you know, so that was a real, and they did a post as well on their Instagram, not naming me, but just saying, we will not work with anyone who doesn't align with our values. And so everybody who knew what was going on already with this big, because obviously these things all happen in these little purity spiral worlds, don't they? But the whole of the birth world knew that right. this was happening to Millie Hill. And then this post came, boom, from above, you know, from this big organization. And it just rubber stamped it. Mm-hmm. It was just extraordinary that they did that because I was literally sat on my sofa crying at what was happening to me. And then they just came in and kind of like endorsed it. You know, I gave it their kind of official stamp of approval. So I'll never forgive that organization for what they did. And I still feel like I'm still processing it all, really. I mean, after that, I didn't really talk about it to anybody, not even my partner for a while, because it was just so terrifying. And I didn't know what was going to happen next. I think that's the thing, that's when these things are happening to you, it's easy with hindsight to say, oh yeah, that happened and this was the time frame of it. But when you're actually in the middle of it, you just think, well, what next? You think, is my publisher going to phone tomorrow and say that they're going to pulp my books? You know, is this going to completely annihilate and destroy everything that I've built, everything that I've written, everything that I've thought, everything that I've got? Am I going to have to sell my house? You know, you just don't know what's coming. It's horrible.
Right. Right.
So it was a really horrible, horrible time. And it took me a few months to work out what to do. And I was very inspired by other women's bravery as well. So I watched Maya Forstar to have her court case here in the UK and win. And so basically what that court case ruled was that, you know, gender critical beliefs are worthy of respect in a democratic society, and that, you know, they are protected under law. And then I watched Jester Wiles, who's a UK artist. I don't know if you know her story, but she had her, she's an embroiderer, and she had some of her work removed from the shop from the Royal Academy. And they literally put on social media that they were removing her work because she was transphobic, because she had written this big essay about why she thinks it's all a load of BS. Mm-hmm. And she ended up in all the media, and the Royal Academy apologized to her. And that, for me, was a really big step. I read the essay by Chimamanda Adichie about it, the title of it is "It Is Obscene," about what had happened to her. Mm-hmm. And I loved the way she was so powerful in her, with her words, and so articulate. And obviously, she's she's an amazing writer. And yeah, so things like that were happening, and I was just thinking, my God, you know, what happened to me is actually not just what happened to me. It's actually a part of a pattern.
Yeah.
It's part of a bigger picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just thought, I'm going to tell my story of what happened to me. So I did. I wrote a blog about it, and it ended up in all the press, and there was a lot of hoo-ha about it, and all the gender critical feminists kind of swept in and took me on and gave me loads of support, which was incredible, really, you know, after what the place I'd been in, where I felt like the whole world hated me. Mm-hmm. It was really, really quite great. And yeah, so that's kind of like this is a really long story, but it's kind of the plotted version was that was how it how it went. And then since then, I've just been, you know, out and proud, really, on, you know, Twitter, etc., and tried to talk about these issues, because I think it's so interesting that I was part of this, you know, attempt to shut women up, I think, because of the topics that I write about.
Yeah.
You know, writing about, you know, birth, periods, all of these areas, initially you'd think, well, what on earth has that got to do with trans ideology? You know, why would anybody want to target a woman like that? She's just minding her own business. It's so female, you know? But on the other hand, I think it's kind of like, you know, that's part of the reason why it happens, because those worlds have been specifically targeted. The sort of the takeover, the language takeover, is very much centered around birth, pregnancy, breastfeeding. This is why we have, you know, women being called menstruators, right. Birthing bodies. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, obviously it kind of ironically kind of puts me directly in the center of some of the conversations. But, you know, I have found it difficult because I am very naturally a left-leaning, inclusive person. Not that there's anything wrong with being right-leaning. I know I said that on another podcast once, and somebody complained that I was very anti-right-wing. It's like, I don't mind what you are. You know, normally I try not to sort of, you know, put people into boxes and decide I don't like them based on those right. boxes. You know, I don't have any, I'm not a prejudiced person. But so I think what's really important is that, yes, of course, if somebody goes into a healthcare situation or say they're in maternity care, I bet you agree with this. If they are a female person who's pregnant, but they identify as a man and they want to be called Rob and have he, him pronouns, then of course I'm not going to tell anyone else what to do, but my feeling is that that should be respected. You should treat that person with absolute compassion, because that's all I've ever written about and stood for, is respectful care.
Sure.
Of what I call women. But, you know, I don't mind what Rob wants to call himself. If respectful care for Rob means being, you know, called him, then that's what Rob should get, because everybody who's having a baby should be treated like a, you know, somebody incredibly special and given completely individualized, loving care that's specific mm-hmm. to what they need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, But the thing that's different is changing language at population level. That's what I've been saying all the way through this. It's fine to call Rob what Rob wants to be called. But if you write a policy document that doesn't include the word woman and it's about maternity, that's something different. That's erasure. That's taking women out of the center of conversation, which women have very long not been at the center of and bloody well should be at the center of.
Yeah.
So that's my issue kind of summed up. It's like, no way am I transphobic. No way am I going to tell anybody how to live their life. No way am I going to tell anybody that they are not what they say they are, or that they don't have the same rights and human rights and rights to respectful care as anybody else.
Right.
But do not take the word woman and the word, you know, female, et cetera, and mess around with it, because we have worked hard to be part of conversations and to be respected and to be in policy documents and to have conversations about our healthcare. And we've only just started to make it the tiniest bit of progress.
Right.
And now we're having to watch our words again. And that's kind of like wrong.
I felt the same. I felt like when we started Venus Rising a couple of years ago now, which doesn't feel like it's been that long, or even when I started as a nurse, I felt like women were starting to really understand more about their bodies and were coming into the birth room a little bit more educated. And I was really excited about that. And now I feel like we are taking, as a culture, a step backwards, and we're erasing women from these, well, we're erasing them.
Yeah.
And so you've kind of already hit on this, but towards the end of your book, and I keep going back to my favorite, but Giving Birth Like a Feminist, you quote Marzen Wagner. And she write, or you write of her words, humanizing birth means understanding that the woman giving birth is a human being, not a machine, and not just a container for making babies. Showing women, half of all people, that they are inferior and inadequate by taking away their power to give birth is a tragedy for all society. Does taking women out of our language take away that power that Wagner was talking about?
Yes, I think it does. I think there's just so much history to women's words being taboo as well, and women's bodies being taboo, and women being taboo, and something that should be kept. Women themselves being taboo, you know, being something that should be hidden away because it's not suitable for public, you know, use kind of thing. You know, and I was... The other day I was thinking about, I think it's really interesting to think back through your, you know, your own history and your family, your, you know, your female bloodline. And, you know, when you think back, it's not many generations. Think back to your grandmother or your great grandmother and like the enormous effort they must have, not in every case, okay, because some, you know, it depends on the story. But in many cases, women had to make quite a lot of effort to not talk about a lot of the things that were happening to them. Certainly not in, you know, they may have had one good girlfriend who came around for tea a lot, who they really sort of talked a lot, you know. But generally speaking, in the world, they weren't going on podcasts talking about their most recent miscarriage, or they weren't, you know, talking about their infertility in a blog, or they, you know, they weren't going to a conference about menopause. You know, no one was talking about these female experiences. And anyone who did, you know, it was really shocking. And so many things were swept under the rug. And one thing that I was thinking about was how much effort that must have taken for women, how much effort they must have had to put into not talking about their own lives and their own experiences, because so much of our, you know, think of like even just now, the menopause conversation is opening up, isn't it? And like a lot of women are like going, I can't believe we're all talking about this. Isn't it fantastic? You know, it's like the first time women have had these public, you know, documentaries being made and celebrities writing books, and it's cracked something open. You know, and all of that suppression of women's experiences. And then suddenly we just have this little blip in history where it starts to be okay. And, you know, social media is playing a role as well. And like everybody sharing what it's actually like to be a woman. And then suddenly, you know, you get a website that's for teenagers about periods, and that you go through the entire website, thousands of words, and somebody has, there's no reference to women or female in it. And you think that's taken the same kind of levels of effort. There's something historic here that's almost linking back. It's somebody has had to spend time going through that website and finding other ways to talk about periods without mentioning women, in the same way that our grandmothers had to go through their lives, finding other ways to talk about their life experience without mentioning their baby loss or their, you know, their awful sex life or their, you know, menopause, you know?
Right. Or their traumatic birth. Yeah.
Yeah, or their traumatic birth. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you talked about birth stories earlier, didn't we? And how, you know, women can't tell their positive birth stories, and then they can't also tell their negative birth stories. There's still all these taboos around talking about our experiences. And now we have this new one. It's, yeah.
And now we also have men winning awards that should go to women. Like, I also am flabbergasted by that, from sports to women of the year to women, you know, and it's, wait a second, that's actually not a woman who won that award.
Yeah. I mean, why did they set up women only awards? Why? Just think about it. I say this to my children when we, you know, I don't talk very much about gender critical feminism to them just yet, because I think sometimes you can, if you thump the tub too much in front of teenagers, then that just gives them some traction. They think, oh, I know what I can, how I can rebel against you, you know, and your stupid ideas. But, you know, when we do have these conversations, those are the sorts of things I tell them about. I'm like, just think about, you know, why do we have women only, you know, shortlists? Why did they set that up? Why did J.K. Rowling call herself J.K. Rowling or Robert Galbraith when she was choosing her pen name? Why didn't she call herself Joanne Rowling? Mm-hmm. That wasn't that long ago. You know,
right?
All of these problems have not yet been solved, and women were trying to work on them. And now, yeah, we set up our women only shortlists, and now we have to accept somebody who has lived like 30 or 40 years of their life as a man mm-hmm. onto a women only shortlist, yeah. as someone who's had all that advantage.
Yeah,
it's absolutely infuriating
and maddening. Yes.
And if you say birthing people, you are propping up that
right.
crap. That yeah. is why I won't say it.
Yeah.
You're propping up that crap, and you're propping up the, you know, the medicalization of children's gender-related distress. And I will not prop up either of those two things, because I don't care who wants to be what and how they want to identify. I'm totally fine for everyone to live their life however they like, but I will not use words that are part of an ideology to prop up an ideology yeah. when I'm speaking about women's stories and women's lives.
Yeah. That, I appreciate you saying it. That's a powerful note to end on, because I'm looking at the clock and I want to be respectful of your time. I want to ask one last question though. Do you have hope, or do you see us getting beyond this? Do you have hope?
Well, I think everybody has to have hope. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep going, would we? But it does. I think there's a lot of, you know, social and cultural change and issues to grapple with for humankind at the moment. And so it's complicated. I think we need to somehow find a way. I think the solution to all of it is for all of us, for everything, for every single problem. I think the solution is for everybody to find a way to reconnect with nature. I think that's what we've lost our grip on. Mm-hmm. We're all guilty every time we pick up our smartphone, and every time we choose to sit and look at social media on our phone instead of going out into the garden and planting something yeah. or going for a walk or looking at the sky
yeah.
Or looking at another human's face and making eye contact with them and having a conversation with them. We're all chipping away at that sort of core of what humans need. And all of these different problems, from the environment to the medicalization of childbirth, to the medicalization of young people with gender dysphoria, to the concept that children are taking on board that you can change, you know, the biology is unimportant. Mm-hmm. All of those things, I think, are all linked by, you know, by that, and by that loss of connection with Mother Earth yeah, or Parent yeah. Earth, as she's going to be rebranded as.
yeah. Tulip, a guest I had on kind of at the end of last season, it was a guest just in the middle of our break, actually. And he said the same thing. He was someone who kind of fell prey to the ideology industry and is now living his life back as a man. And he said the same thing. We need to get off our computers and back outside. And I agree. I could really talk to you for so long. I'm sure we could share stories as well, but I am going to wrap up now. Do you have anything else you'd like to say, Millie?
No, just thanks very much for having me. One more thing to say is that sure. I am starting work on book 4.
Yes.
And I can't say what specifically it's going to be about yet, but it will be about women's health. And I'm running this new Substack called The Book Forge, where people can come along and watch me as I write the book. So starting from now up to the first copy deadline, and then beyond in through the editing process and to publication. So it'd be a good Substack to follow for anyone who's interested in writing, because I'm going to be giving lots of tips. People are always asking me, how do you get published? How do I get my idea into a book? Blah, blah, blah. So that I'm going to focus in on that. But also people who want to watch me struggle. And you know, maybe people even don't like me, they can join it, because then they can see me crying over my laptop on a weekly basis, especially near the deadline. So it'll be good for them, and it'll also be good for people who are interested in, you know, feminism and women's health and this topic, because I'm going to be sharing. One of the things I found is that when you're writing an article or a book, you do all this research and you end up with absolutely masses of stuff and you can't put it all in the book. So anything that is fascinating but just can't be put in detail into the books, for example, there'll be a podcast about that or a blog about that. So I'm hoping it's going to be quite nice and rich. And it's called The Book Forge because I live in an old forge where they used to make horseshoes. And now I write my books in there. So I thought, well, that's kind of like a nice metaphor.
So. It is. So give us the website again, thebookforge.com, or what was it again?
It's www.thebookforge.substack.com.
Okay.
But it's in my link tree on all my social medias. It's in my link tree. So
perfect. And I'll include that link when this goes with the little blurb as well.
Thank you.
That accompanies this. Yeah, of course. Of course. I want to direct all of our listeners to your homepage, where they can also probably find that link as well. You can read a lot of Millie's writings and find her work there at www.milliehill.co.uk. And that's MILLIHILL.co.uk. I also encourage all of our listeners to go out and purchase each of her books. They can be found easily on Amazon and Kindle and Audible. That's where I listened. And finally, you can follow Millie on Twitter with the handle at Millie Hill. Again, that's MILLI. Or on Instagram at Millie.Hill. And I think we have accomplished our goal here today, which is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses. So Millie, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.